Well, this looks like we're starting a Congress here. I wouldn't be a bit surprised what we'll have one. One of the very fine things that about this Congress is the fact that we're not going to cover very much of the material which was advertised. You know, that's such a bore. It's duplicative. It's redundant. And everybody expects to hear about nuclear fission, radiation. A great many people probably stayed away simply because they thought they were going to get showered with atomic particles. Very fine thing, these atomic particles. They keep the nuclear physicists busy. They keep the government introverted. And we can go on about our business. But we'll cover all that as time goes on in this Congress. But right now, I want to thank you, all of you, for being here. Thank you. I see all of my very good friends here in London here. And as time goes on, why, we will introduce Mauster to you, as though you don't know you. Truth of the matter is, we had a very, very fine program. Tremendous program. Gorgeous. I mean, I had notes on every lecture. Had it all right down to the last, last semicolon. Not down to all of the commas, but down to the semicolons at least. Had large stacks of paper I was going to put up here. I made the boys get a podium up here just so that I could have a place to put all these lecture notes. But last night, we were down to a restaurant, and we lost the whole bale of them. Champagne was too good, and that was that. So I'm really left here without much of a program. Does anybody have a Congress program? I'll have to find out what's on it. Thank you very much, Johann. This is the Congress on Nuclear Radiation and Health. Now I know. That was in my notes, too. Now, first day, it says here, is Friday, April the 12th. Well, I guess that covers that. The second day is Saturday, April the 13th. The third day is Sunday, April the 14th. The fourth day is Sunday, April the 15th. That's Monday, April the 15th. That's a mistake. And then we get down to the buffet. And that's that. We'd have had it, you know. Well, now that's pretty full Congress schedule there. I want to call your attention really to some of the lecture titles. I want you to take these up rather carefully because you'll be expected to remember them when you report to the pearly gates or something. Anyway, this one here that says first lecture. Well, that's what you're getting now. First lecture, name of that. Now, this thing called break, I'm afraid that's an Americanization that has crept into Scientology congresses and schedules, and I think they even use it these days at Oxford. But it doesn't mean smash the teacup. It really doesn't. It's a rather dull subject to break. But we will try to make it interesting. Now we get down to second lecture, and that's covers completely and conclusively the second lecture. Now we get down to the third lecture. The third lecture here. A very fine lecture. I haven't got the subject of it yet, but... Now we get to something interesting. Dinner. There we arrived. And the fourth lecture, are you going to be surprised? Now, that's the first lecture of the day of this conference. That's the first real dress parade lecture. That will be a good one. Somebody else is delivering that. I'm not. Now, the fifth lecture comes also after a break. And the fifth lecture, I'm afraid I'm going to have to run that teacup gag out of some of the people here. I see that now. But after the fifth lecture, you will then be well educated. Tonight you're going to hear about the theory and practice of radiating from a very, very skilled lecturer. You're also, I think, going to hear about flying saucers. Isn't that nice? We're talking to you about flying saucers so you'll know what to use when you exit from the planet here. We won't go so far as to give you a rundown on the controls, but we'll at least tell you something about recognition of them. And then you'll be all prepared. You'll be all set. Actually, we start to really swing into things on the second day. Because here you get a very, very fine series of lectures, beginning with Personnel Efficiency 1 and Personnel Efficiency 2 in the morning. And the staff of the Hazy know their business on this, and they're going to give you a very good rundown on this. And that's a very fine thing, and I'm glad they are. So there you're assured of some good programming and some interesting stuff. That's quite interesting. The field auditor will learn a little bit about how you present personnel efficiency and so forth to a group, and the person who knows relatively little about Scientology will undoubtedly finish up these personnel efficiency courses knowing a great deal more than he thought possible. And perhaps even some of the field auditors will discover that there were fundamentals in the subject. Now you have this interesting fact here, though. All during the second day afternoon, you're going to have to bear with me. Because I have to go for broke right there on this great big exclamatory thing, nuclear radiation. And lecture 6, lecture 7, and lecture 8, which stresses, of course, the eighth dynamic aspect of the nuclear physicist in our modern world, are devoted exclusively and horrendously to nuclear physics. Can we live with it? No. Now that is actually tomorrow afternoon's program. Now we get down to something much more interesting here in the ninth lecture and the tenth lecture in the evening. Now that's really interesting. There's going to be lecture material there that you have never before dreamed of. Never before dreamed of. It'll just be totally revelatory because unless the Minister of Health and some of the other chaps elect only to come in the evening, we'll group process that night. And group processing gives you a wealth of material that you have never dreamed of before. That's for sure, isn't it? Because that's all about you. I'm going to run some of the newest and latest group processes. Group processing has become a terribly interesting fact these days, a tremendous fact.
better gains, higher gains are being made, and lower level cases are being broken by group processing than ever before. So we're going to stress that considerably. Now we get over here to the third day, and life gets much more interesting with personnel efficiency 3 and personnel efficiency 4, and it gets tremendously interesting with the, well, the first interesting lecture that day is the 14th in the evening. I give the ones in the afternoon. I have to fill in, you know. You're getting, I think, Odo Berry will be here, and he'll give it to you, and you'll know a lot more than thought. So your next real information after you get through with the group processing is actually Sunday evening, because that afternoon is devoted entirely to briefing people on what's been done recently and how you go about processing, auditing with demonstrations, and that sort of thing, you know, just dull stuff that we just have to cover, you know. Some unlucky person in this audience is going to sit up here for a long time with me processing him, just to show you how it's done. I looked across the audience here just a moment ago to see if there were any shivers, and I saw one, so that's elected. And now we get up here to the fourth day. And the fourth day is personnel efficiency 5 and 6, which finishes off that series. And then we have the 16th, 17th, and 18th lectures. And again, these are relatively unimportant lectures, merely devoted to exactly how to be a good auditor, exactly how you do these processes and procedure CCH in full, which is the latest procedure that has been cracking the lower level. And good news for you high-toned cases. I know you're getting tired of these far south cases, you know. Good news for you high-toned cases. We can now process them. And here we have another very, very important event on the fourth day, and that is dinner. And then we have a party. And the party, we will be sure to have a very good time. So if you can just be patient, we'll get through to the party somehow or another. And then we can enjoy ourselves. Very good. All right, I'm going to ask you a question now. Do we have a Congress here?
Yes.
Very good, thank you. I'm going to ask you that a couple of times. Has the Congress started yet?
Yes.
All right, well, we've agreed on it. Okay, are we now in full swing?
Yes.
Very good, so I better get to work. It is quite interesting to be able to single out, of the entirety of man, three factors more important and more valuable than any other factors. Now, some of the old-timers think I'm going to talk about ARC. And although the R is important, and although the A is important in the affinity, reality, and communication triangle, they actually do not rival in importance that one C, which is communication. Communication is the first of these three factors. And we all know a great deal about communication. But it's fitting that we begin this Congress with some communication on the subject of communication. And man beginning to communicate on the subject of communication is doing the strangest thing that he ever did in his entire career, which is not to talk about talking, but to communicate about communicating. And this is a very strange thing that we, rising from our forebears, I think some of them could grunt. In fact, I think there are people back on the genetic line who could manage a grunt or two. I know I was listening to a political speech the other day, and the only expressive things in it were the grunts. It said that the chap had had a good dinner. But that man could communicate, to be heard by man, was hardly even dreamed of years ago, many, many years ago, that a tribe could be heard by another tribe. Oh, that was impossible. Over there, they didn't grunt. They glucked. And they went, bling. Different language. Entirely different language. As we looked across the face of the world, we found an almost infinite number of tribes. And these eventually, by processes of communication, boiled down to a very few tribes. There's the French tribe and the American tribe and the English tribe. Not much left of the Italian tribe anymore, but they're there. And these various tribes developed their grunts into articulation, which they call language, and then explained to one another that they had to go to war with one another because they did not speak the other's language. You couldn't understand the fellow because you couldn't talk to him. And that was about as much as man knew on the subject of communication in 1950. And ever since 1950, we've been working very hard to find a few more scattered data, if they existed. Now, what were the data that were important? Any old-timer in Dianetics and Scientology knows this. He knows you can't communicate without affinity. He knows there is no real communication without reality. And we have that famous triangle, the affinity, reality, and communication triangle, which is the most we knew about communication, really, in 1950. Even then, we ourselves believed that it was words, words, words. So I'm pouring out a tremendous number of words at you. But actually, those words would never arrive or never be understood if they are not spoken with affinity, which they are. And if they were not addressed to the reality of what we can do in Scientology, which is not very contestable today. And so we have communication. Communication, then, was understood by man before 1950 to be an improved grunt. That was his highest technology. Communication, that was an improved grunt. You said, "Mama, I'm hungry." That's communicating. We said, "You dog, get back in your kennel." That communicated. It was words, wasn't it? It said, "Everybody who lives on the other side of the Danube is a barbarian." Well, those were words, so they must have communicated. Naturally, everybody on the other side of the Danube then, hearing these, would understand what he was supposed to do and would at once become a barbarian. Man's technology was totally involved in the band of symbols. And he'd even fallen below that. And do you know that there are actually people around who will not emit symbols? This communication aside, they won't emit symbols. You walk up to a chap on the street, you say, "How are you?" He doesn't even grunt. He looks at you stonily, you know. "How dare you speak to me?" is sort of the thought that would occur to him. Huh? That's an interesting thing, isn't it? You can't even get a symbol out of a fellow. Well, therefore, the ability of an individual to communicate is a case in point. An individual, in his management of life, in his ability, in how well he will succeed or not, is measured by his ability to receive and give communication. If he is able in life, he can receive and give communication. If he is not able, he cannot easily receive or give communication. Only it is not an Aristotelian piece of logic. It isn't that people just, this person doesn't communicate and that person does communicate. It's not black and white. It's a gradient scale. And up here, someone can communicate very well, and down here, someone does not communicate at all. But between these two is a tremendous band of difference of communication. By his communication, you may know him.
Now, we have proceeded a long way when we've learned this.
We have the tone scale as given in Science of Survival, the chart of evaluation, that is totally based upon affinity, reality, and communication, expression of, and of these three, the most important is communication. We talk to somebody, we say, how are you? He says, well, I don't think I'll buy any. What do we know about this man? He's not only out of communication, but he is not aware that you're there. The reality is that low. He thinks you're a fishmonger. We have a thing called a communication lag, the length of time it takes a person to answer the exact question put to him is the communication lag. The exact question, answer thereto, and the number of seconds or minutes or hours or eternities intervening between the two go from the moment that the question is put to him to the moment he answers that exact question. And it tells you then that he can speak an outflow after having received an exact meaning. You say, how are you? Some chap who's in good shape says, oh, not too bad. The fellow who's in terrible shape, we say, how are you? He says, well, and he thinks it over, and it's good, you can see it go through the circuits. It winds down around here, and it walks over this way, goes up a little elevator here. A little train of cars runs around in front of his face, each one with a sign on it. He's got a big machine over on this side. The wheels all ran in it, then it stopped. And he says to you, finally, I don't think I'll buy any. Not only did he not receive the question put to him, but it took an unconscionable long time for him to tell you that he hadn't the clue what you were talking about. Now, that is a communication lag. A communication lag would be, how are you? Not too bad. The length of time between how are you and not too bad. But if we say, how are you? I don't think I'll buy any, the fellow says. Do you know the communication lag is going on forever? That communication lag is still continuing. He has not answered your question. And it's a great oddity and one of the skills of a Scientologist, but if he asks the question again, and again, and again, and again, and again, the person will eventually answer the same question. He'll eventually answer the question. Now we ask this fellow who said, I don't think I'll buy any. We say to him again, how are you? Chain of cars, the elevator, everything, machine, so forth. And he says, but do you really have to let the air out of the spokes? You again ask him. You see, a communication lag is still running from the first moment you ask the question. Still running. And you say, prodding him along, how are you? Well, this time there's something happened. He says, it isn't the square root. You prod him along again. Understand, this communication lag is still running from the first time the question was asked him. You say again, how are you? Oh, he says, it's you, Joe. Communication lag still running. How are you? You ask him again. Confidentially, I feel like hell. And he asks, answered the question put to it. And the length of time it took from the first moment you asked the question, from the time the question was answered, is the communication lag. And it might be hours, and it could be an eternity. Very probably, the reason most people are alive and surviving at this time is they are running a communication lag. And they've never run the lag out. Somebody asked them a powerful question somewhere on the beginning of track, you know. Universe beginning, somebody asked them, they said, I say, are you really a Thetan? And here all of these millennia later, billions, trillions of years later, the fellow is still trying to answer the question, hasn't yet responded. Now, this is a ridiculous look at survival, but certainly one would believe that survival is of this complexion in most people, because when you speak to them, they're obviously thinking about something else. And I think you have, when you speak to most people, intruded upon one of these eternity communication lags. You actually probably should stand in the presence of such people with your hat in your hand, with a rather reverent look upon your face, because you're interrupting something sacred. Now, this little technology right there was the difference between being able to audit the case and not being able to. We asked first the question, and we knew better than to ask another question until he'd answered the one we asked. Otherwise, we just put him into a continuous auditing session. And so we did get answers to our question. Very recently, testing our old technology, and this is quite old, of course, in Scientology, but testing it again, a person was quite disturbed, spinning. And I simply dragged out this time-honored one, which is a rather long lag. You know, if a person really tells you how he is, really, he normally runs through a considerable lag before he arrives there, you know. You ask most people, you say, how are you? He says, I'm fine. It's a form of social greeting. You know, he's sitting there with a broken leg with Berry Berry. You say, how are you? You haven't actually received the answer to your question. It just sounds like it. There's not something else in it. Is it the answer to your question? Well, the answer to your question is indicated by his body, the reality, and his body is not in good condition, and therefore you judge that the reality of the answer is very poor. Therefore, it's not being made to you in present time. And so we become a little smarter about communication. Compare it to the reality of the situation. The whole town is going to pieces, you see. The buildings are falling down, and the walls are all caving in and so forth. And you say to this fellow, you say, exciting, isn't it? And the fellow looks and he says, oh, I don't think so. See, the environment he's in has lots of motion in it and so forth. And if we looked at him a little more closely, we would see a sort of a glazed look in his eyes. He has not answered our question. He has answered some other question that was put to him in the last war or something. If we ask him the question again, and you said, exciting, isn't it, you know? Don't you think it's exciting? He would say finally, wow. I mean, it's terrible. Why didn't he tell you that in the first place? He was dazed. He was stunned. He was unconscious. He was saying, well, it can't affect me. It can't affect me. It can't affect me. That's what he was saying all the time. And therefore, it doesn't disturb me. Carrying on with it one way or the other. The attitude most people are in with regard to atomic radiation, atomic bombs, and world war, I don't know, I think we've already had 3, 4, 5, and 6, haven't we? World War 12. At least the next one will probably be worth 9. So, call it World War XII. People are looking at this tremendous spectacle of people testing off bombs that pollute the atmosphere and all that. And what do we find? And they're saying, oh, I don't think it's very interesting. It's nothing to it, you know. There's the man's town falling to pieces, and he says, oh, I don't think it's very interesting. Why does he say this? He's dazed. He's numb. The state of shock is so great that he cannot respond to it. Therefore, he's running a committee communication lag on the question. This other fellow, though he said the town was coming to pieces, we asked him if he didn't think it was exciting or something. This fellow eventually said to us, wow! Good heavens, what's happening here? See, he woke up to it and looked at it. One of these days, the world is going to run its lag through this atomic bomb radiation thing, and it's going to look at all of these politicos, the rest of them, they're so happily, busily, you know, dropping a little gamma on you, and a gamma for you, and a gamma for you. And the world is going to say, wow, what's this? And they're going to ask the question, what are you people doing? Now, the other side's in the comm lag now. And they say, well, we're testing. You what? We're testing. What are you testing? We're testing to find out if bombs go off. But you found that out years ago. I know, well, we got to test them. Who says so? I don't know. We can't find him. Well, it's one of the characteristics of communication that if a person doesn't give you an answer after a while, I've noticed some of you get a little nervous when I was marking up the comm lag up. You're getting just a little edgy. The reason for that is you walk up to somebody and you are looking at him, you're addressing yourself to him, and you say, how are you? I don't think I'll buy any. All during that time, you're going, you're perfectly happy at first, you see, because communication is there, you thought. But when it becomes more and more apparent that there isn't, your affinity for him goes down, 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 down. And you say, his reality has something wrong with it. Is he a man? Is he a beast? A dog? What is he? And your affinity, therefore, thereby, failed. And his reality, as far as you're concerned, failed to some degree. Why? Because he didn't reply. And the world one of these days is going to say to the atomic physicists, to the politicos, to the boys who are getting a couple of quick shillings, manufacturing these things, they're going to say, what are you doing? And these fellows are going to go comm lag, comm lag, comm lag, comm lag, comm lag. Lubbock is probably going to stand there saying, well, we're waiting to hear it. We're waiting to hear the answer. Any moment we expect somebody is going to give us an answer. They're going to say, now wait a minute. These are not men. These are not men. These are something different. Martians, maybe, in a disguise. But they're not men. They're not part of us. They realize by blowing atomic fission all over the world, by using a weapon that is not valid in war, and will never be valid in war, these people are affecting their wives, children, parents, and any friend they have. And a fellow who will put, with malice aforethought, every friend he has, his wife, his children, his home, in that much jeopardy, cannot be human. And that's what the public will someday say. And if there's any public left by that time, they'll tear these chappies to bits. They'll dig the grave up of the man who started it.
They'll strew Einstein's remains 3/4 across the continent.
That is the fate
of this particular research, what we're looking at, by the laws of communication in Scientology.
Why? Because the public is now running a dazed comm lag. It doesn't know what this is all about. You think it is just absence of information? You think it's just the little bits of information that these people don't have? You mean you think they have to be educated? Oh, I'm afraid they know far more about atomic fission. They know when they have gastroenteritis, if you please, and their sinusitis is worse, and they look around and they say, why am I ill? Why am I ill all the time? And somebody says to them, it's just, you're just getting old, or you've reached 19, and some mother says, but my first two children got along all right in their first year. But this third one just doesn't seem to be moting at all. Sick all the time with a terrible rash of some kind. Nobody can do anything for it. What is this? What is this rash? They keep asking the question. Someday or another, the answer comes through. Atomic radiation. And if you think that it's safe to do anything to the child of a mother, try it sometime. When you're tired of life, when you don't care what happens anymore, when you just feel a completely wild abandon about the whole thing, walk up to some lady on the street and grab her baby and say you're going to dash its brains out. Up to this time, she was a very docile character. She was an absolute model of domestic obedience. If you've got any eyeballs left in your head in the next couple of minutes, we don't ordinarily look on human beings as savage or capable of a savage or forceful expression of opinion. But if you take somebody's children away from them, if you do things to people at this level, and they find out about it, that expression of savagery will occur. Even if it's made with the last breath in their body. Therefore, the world is heading toward a rather uncalm period. The question has been asked, why am I sick all the time? The medicos in the dispensaries, getting in people these days with gastroenteritis, skin rashes, hives, lung cancer, very high instances, they're saying, what do you suppose this is all about? We didn't have this many people this way before, you know. They're asking the question. Other people are asking the question. They'll start expecting an answer, and when they don't get a clear one, they will react just as you would react and feel like pulling his bowler hat down over his ears on somebody. You camaraderie, you walk up, you say, how are you? You know? And the fellow says, well, you think it was a parliamentary question or a debate you were just about to start, you know? Well, I don't know. And finally, well, I don't know how you were, but in a moment you think to yourself you're going to be in an awfully second-hand condition. You get the idea. A person's anger mounts to the degree that he's not answered. It is not safe to leave the questions of a population unanswered. Now, the world of Scientology doesn't stand on one side of this or the other. A scientific subject does not take sides. Only individuals can do such a thing. But if it caused us trouble, then it would be an important subject, wouldn't it? Well, it's been causing us trouble. Why do you suppose we've had to have better and better and better and better techniques? We had a technique once and it worked. How come it got rougher?
How come the cases that presented themselves in 1950 were rougher than the cases in 1947? How come the cases in 1954 were rougher than the cases in 1950? Why are the cases in 1956 so much further south than the furthest south cases we ran into in 1955? What is happening? Well, atomic radiation has a mental repercussion of considerable magnitude. It isn't necessarily that the little radioactive particles go wiggle-wiggle in anybody's neurons. It's just that people start flinching from the world around them. And when they start flinching, they become more and more only ones. They go downscale. Space is much less theirs. And they become harder to audit, harder to process, harder to treat. I was amazed to have a look at 1950 engram sheets by the Hubbard Dianetic Research Foundation in Elizabeth, New Jersey. All of these files not too long ago came home. It's wonderful. Real rough case, an alcoholic. Terrible rough case, an alcoholic, been institutionalized for 3 years, can get an electric shock, came in, we ran out this, that, and the other thing, and we ran an engram and so, and all the auditor's phrases and engram running and everything is in the thing. And then included with it was a letter from his family saying that he had been absolved from further culpability and commitment and some sort of trial that he was facing. And then another letter attached to it saying he'd gotten married and was living a normal life. See, they just ran a whole series of engrams. That's all. And that's all he did, 1950. Go on, find me somebody out in society now. All you got to do is run an engram on. Go on, find me. You're not going to. We had to have better answers and better answers and better answers and better answers, and we kept being forced further and further and further into delving throughout the universe and throughout the craniums and throughout everywhere to find a better button, a better way to release, a better auditor presence. In all due respect to us, we found it. But I consider it an imposition. Every year you say, this will do so-and-so for cases. You know? All you have to do is so-and-so and so-and-so. You've seen me, you've heard me. You have. All we had to do is so-and-so for this case, and it fixes him up, and so forth. Every one of you that's listened to me and gone out and audited somebody, you can actually tell, give me the answer back. That happened to be true, didn't it? We do so-and-so for a case, and it did so-and-so. Why didn't it work the next year? Why do we take some old technique now that's good and moth-eaten and so forth? ARC straight wire. That was a killer once. I've seen a psycho just unspin, just as nice and pleasant as you ever saw in your life. Just say, now, recall something that is really real to you. Recall a time when you were in communication with someone. Recall a time when you felt some affinity with someone. Next thing you know, he comes up to present time. Run it on people at large today. They don't come up to present time with it. Why? Something is disturbing the mental image picture which they carry around in their cocoa. Something is gnawing upon these people. Our attitude is not quite as bad as the attitude of a fellow down in lower Mississippi River. He settled down there and had an awful lot of kids, and a traveler came along. A traveler saw huge, great, big alligator, and the alligator was eating up a little human child. The fellow looked around for the nearest habitation, and he ran up there. Here's a fellow sitting on the porch, and there's children under the porch, and children in the house. The fellow sitting on the porch, and the traveler says to him, I've just seen an alligator down there eating up a human child. Fellow on the porch turns around, looks back inside the house, and he says, Mandy, I told you something was getting those chillings. I'm afraid our look at it isn't quite that careless. But we can demonstrate conclusively, and rather easily, the fact that radiation inhibits the release of mental image pictures and aberration. We can demonstrate this rather easily. Anyone with an X-ray machine available and somebody he doesn't like very much can make the experiment. What you do is inspect somebody's mental image pictures, tabulate what sort of condition he is in, actually estimate his comm lag, get some sort of an APA graph of the situation, and then put him up in front of an X-ray machine and hit him with no more dosage than is ordinarily given in getting an X-ray of the skull. Now, a short time afterwards, you understand he hasn't been injured, he hasn't been worried, nothing physical has struck him, and we ask him these same questions, and we inspect his mental image pictures, and we find out that he is less able to move on his time track. He is less able to get these pictures in and look at them and throw them away. His APA will have suffered and so forth. What have you hit him with? You've hit him with nothing more nor less than a cousin of gamma. Now, of course, it's perfectly legal to hit people with X-ray, but people who have a lot of X-ray suffer very badly when they are struck by gamma. Was contributed. In other words, we hit people with X-ray, make this experiment. Of course, you understand it takes a Scientologist, not a head shrinker. A head shrinker is not likely to know enough about inspecting minds to be able to observe. But if you told him what the factors of a mind were, why he could tell you, then even he could see the difference. Because one of the reasons people are adrift on this subject is they have no way of inspecting it, no way of looking over people, no way of measuring up what is actually done or not done by radiation. So it's all a big mystery. But to a Scientologist, it would be no mystery if he cared to make that experiment. If he knows somebody that's going to have a back X-ray, he should give the person a little test of one kind or another. Inspect these mental image pictures, see the ease with which this person might or might not be able to run a lock. Let him go take his X-ray, bring him back, and check over the same mental picture, and you will discover that he was not as capable when he came back. To make it very positive, you'd have to give him a series of 15 or 20 X-rays, and then you would find out that he was a black case. This is the reaction of radiation upon the human being. This is what is happening to the human beings on Earth here today. And this is what has been happening to us. So it became our business, didn't it? Some hand was reaching into our auditing sessions that we did not quite suspect. People were easier to audit in 1947 than they were in 50. People were easier to audit in 1954 than they were in 1956. People were easier to audit in 55 than they are right here at this present moment. But we've gone for broke. We have already overreached the ability of radiation to encroach upon Scientology. I've been able to do a great deal of experimentation since I almost knocked myself off over in Ireland last February 56. I've looked this over with great care. There's been a great many tests. A great deal of experience has been gained in this, and we actually can process them faster today than they can go downhill on the extant radiation pollution of Earth's air. Scientologists are probably the only fairly well people on Earth today. You haven't looked lately at the public at large. I'm sure you haven't. What I'm saying to you would all of a sudden be revelatory of explaining an observation, but you haven't made this observation. So I ask you to make it now. Look at the people in the street. Their cheeks are gray. They are having difficulties that they have not had before, by and large. If you were to ask these people, when did you begin to feel badly in life? They tell you, anything from 1945, 1950, You've asked them, when did you realize something was happening to you? But you just said, was there any change in your livingness, your health condition over the last 20 years? And, oh, yes. Well, now, this would seem reasonable if we were addressing it to people who were 40 or 50, but when we ask somebody who is 15 or 16, or who was 15 or 16 in 1945, and find out that it's been within the last 2 or 3 years, or when we ask somebody who was 15 or 16 in 1945, and find out that it was 1945 when they started to feel badly, we assume that this is rather peculiar, because children of 15 and 16, teenagers, do not ordinarily feel worse. Do you follow this? I mean, we've got, we have something at work here. Now, I'm not trying to back up the hearse. I'm not trying to scare you, because there's far too much hysteria in the world today on this subject. Far too much hysteria. Nobody realizes this like a Scientologist. If you've got people worried enough about something and resisting it hard enough, he would then suffer accordingly,
right?
So the more worry there is about this, why, the less advance there is. Truth of the matter is, we have the subject pretty well taped today. We have, whether or not auditing would work on it or not, I have managed to develop a chemical assist of one kind or another, which seems to do rather fantastic things, and which opens up the future research areas in the direction that very probably man can overcome this biochemically. Many people are working on that this time. It just happens, and there will be many better results, I am sure, eventually. It just happens that I was in there early, and we managed to kick together the stuff that does the job. Almost kills you in the process, but you come out the other end feeling fine. Now, that stuff is dianazine. We'll take this up a great deal more tomorrow and just passing it. Just commenting now, we have this factor of a biochemical assist, which is pretty good and offers a great deal of promise. And we have, in addition to that, skill in auditing plus auditing techniques. Skill in auditing, teachable, three things. We've got the skill in auditing, the auditing technique, and the skills necessary to teach an auditor to audit. And you have those three things today, and so you have riches. In other words, you've got four new, relatively new, sweeping developments here, where all of which are tremendously beneficial in the direction of radiation. And you want to know what particular process it is. There is one process which is quite fantastic in its efficacy on radiation, but the truth of the matter is that any processing advances in that direction. Just any processing has tendency to take care of it. All right. Scientology is not devoted to deradiating people. That is very far from its fundamental use, but it has some uses in that direction and can illuminate the scene considerably in view of the fact that it was born on the face of Earth at almost the same time that nuclear physics was born on the face of Earth. We can see there is some possibility that nuclear physics can be kept from running away with the world by a knowledge of the mind adequate to handle even the worst of nuclear physics. And that's a rather happy state of affairs. Nobody invested any money, however, to make nuclear physics and radiation known. Nobody invested any pennies at all from a governmental charitable society basis. When they wrote their $3 billion check for the atomic bomb, when FDR sat at his great big desk and signed that $3 billion check and says, here, boys, build an atomic bomb. He didn't write a check for 5 cents that said, here's how we defend a nation, a people, or an individual against one. Remember that. And it was up to us, me and guys sitting all over the world in Scientology and Dianetics, and the funds that we could scrounge up one way or the other, without much interest, in some cases with public mockery of what we were doing, and it was up to us, somehow or another, to put a harness on this beast called atomic fission. It's been a rather long, hard, uphill job. But it has been a totally private activity. The person who buys auditing, the person who buys training, the person who contributes his membership, the person who by his own work writes suggestions in Veron, the maintenance of a centralized office, the coordination of this material, has all been paid for by private individuals, most of whom would have made their bankers awfully mad at them if they'd written a check for £1,000 as their total fortune. In other words, we were little people in the world, financially, not powerful, raging tycoons of one kind or another, and we went ahead rather quietly, and we have done a job, and we are already experiencing some of the fruits of that job in saying that we can check the effects of radiation. We understand man well enough now so that it is possible for him to be salvaged from some of the consequences of future war. And there's some possibility not only for ourselves but for the race. So we have made progress on this. I don't tell you that this is a totally wrapped up package, that we know everything we will ever know. But I will tell you that private thought, quiet activity, finances somehow or another kept together and fairly carefully expended have to a marked degree overwhelmed this beast called nuclear physics and radiation. And that a few people such as ourselves, the only few people such as ourselves, the only group on earth that has made any progress in this direction at all, and that's for sure, to actually harness and muzzle the amount of destructive potential which existed and which exists in the air of Earth today, with no more finance than we've had, with no more government support than we have had, amounts to my way of thinking a considerable miracle. And therefore, at least from my viewpoint, I am very proud of you, I am very proud of us. And so we start a Congress. Thank you.